All right, I got to be quick. This is a full 55-minute lecture on carbon sequestering of the forests and why we need to save the forests, because they're a very important way to sequester carbon. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Also on KPW.org.
Crisis, because that's where we are today. It's moved from an impending threat to a lived reality of so many of us, and the marginalized communities amongst us are always the hardest hit. You know, currently there are 417 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You might know the number 350 as the number that we need to have in order to avoid climate catastrophe. We are far over 350 right now. And so the climate discussion necessarily needs to look at two different parts. The first is ending emissions of carbon dioxide, which has been the main focus of the climate movement for so long, talking about the transportation sector and the energy sector and fossil fuel emissions. So that's one, ending emissions. And the other is atmospheric carbon drawdown. How do we get the carbon that is already in the atmosphere out? How do we get us back to 350 parts per million? And that might seem like a really, really heavy lift, especially for people who are focused on technological solutions. But we are here to tell you a hopeful story tonight, to tell you a story about ecosystems that are our allies in both decreasing emissions, if we manage them properly, and drawing down atmospheric carbon, sequestering carbon, and storing it in forests. Because we in the Pacific Northwest are blessed to live in one of the best ecosystems for carbon storage in the entire world. So tonight we're going to talk about the amazing opportunity we have right now, the new administration that's much more hopeful than hurtful, and the opportunities to try and protect and preserve our mature forests for carbon sequestration and all the co-benefits of biodiversity that comes with that, different ways that we can do that, both the scientific basis and the policy advocacy that we want to see. So with that context, I'm going to pass it over to our panel. I'm going to introduce them all now, and then they'll pass the baton between themselves as we go. Our first presenter is Dr. Erica Fleischman. She is the director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University. Second will be Dr. Natalie Dawson of Audubon, Alaska. Third, we have Susan Jane Brown, a lawyer with the Western Environmental Law Center. And finally, to wrap us up, Kristen Boyles, a lawyer with Earth Justice. So,
despite my current position, I am trained in ecology rather than atmospheric science. And I am well aware that as climate changes and as land use continues to change, we're asking a lot of the ecosystems in which we live and work. Next slide, please. Most of my experience has been in the Intermountain West, primarily in the Great Basin. And I love this place like none other, the Great Basin, but one of the things that you notice in the Great Basin is that there are not a whole lot of trees. It's mostly shrubland, although there are some woodlands at in the mountains and at different elevations. So about a year ago, next slide, please, I moved to Oregon. And next slide. One of the things that I noticed pretty quickly moving to Oregon is, oh my gosh, there are a lot of trees here. And my friends are really sick of going hiking with me because I tend to just kind of look up and go, oh my gosh, there are so many trees and they're so big. Next slide, please. So thinking about, thinking about the carbon cycle, and a lot of us had carbon cycle in high school biology, but unless you're dealing with this every day, you may not remember a whole lot about the carbon cycle. So carbon cycle 101, very easy. Plants consume carbon dioxide as they photosynthesize and grow. Plants and animals also emit carbon dioxide, and carbon moves among different parts of ecosystems that function as sinks, which means they take up more carbon dioxide than they emit, or sources, which means that they emit more than they absorb. Next slide, please. So something one of my friends came up with that I think is really useful is people tend to talk in terms of how much carbon, and it's really hard to kind of conceptualize how much carbon humans are putting into the atmosphere. So she came up with something for one of her classes in terms of how much carbon are humans releasing into the atmosphere. And in 2017, humans released the carbon dioxide weight equivalent of 6.3 billion elephants. So if carbon and carbon dioxide seem sort of like, I can't really get my head around it. I mean, I have difficulty getting my head around it. How much is really out there? Why is it having an effect? Imagine 6.3 billion elephants. It's a heck of a lot of carbon. And next slide, please. Across the United States, if you look for the darker green areas, this isn't a surprise to any of you, the majority of that carbon in terms of the sinks is in the forests in the northwestern United States. So those dark green areas, including, not coincidentally, much of Oregon, much of Northern California, much of Washington, and areas further north. Next slide, please. So to just get a sense of, you know, how much, and I love looking at this because I can compare the ecosystems that I know and that I live in and that I work in. If you look at those dark green areas that you saw in the previous slide, and then take a look at the area in the red box and some of the others, this is kind of the magnitude of how much carbon storage is in the forests in the Pacific Northwest. It pretty much dwarfs what's going on in other ecosystems in the Western United States. And the uptake in the Western United States, it's about the sequestration of the current standing wood in the Western United States in the older forests is the equivalent of about 6 years of fossil fuel emissions from that entire area across the Western United States. So it is a substantial uptake. Next slide, please. This also can give you a sense of those sources and sinks, what I was talking about with carbon flux. So this is just pointing out Oregon in terms of emissions and uptake. So the minus signs in here are taking up more carbon dioxide than they're emitting. So generally speaking, you know, grasslands and shrublands don't sequester that much carbon. Forests, especially the forests in the Pacific Northwest, sequester a heck of a lot of carbon. So it's a very efficient ecosystem in terms of carbon sequestration. Next slide, please. And the best way to continue sequestering that carbon is basically to keep it in trees that are growing, that are in the ground. Where there have been a number of credible studies on carbon storage in wood products, and basically as standing trees are converted into wood products, a lot of carbon is emitted, either from waste products or decomposition. Some of the calculations for wood products also don't take into account the transportation and the processing associated with making wood products. And there also are effects relative to soil compaction and nutrient removal that accompany removal of trees. One of the things I like to say is that trees don't levitate. So when humans extract trees from the ground, we don't sort of magically, you know, suck them up. There's a lot of ground disturbance, and that has ecological effects that in terms of carbon sequestration and other factors are not necessarily desirable. Next, please. So this kind of gives you a sense of how much carbon is stored in forests in the Pacific Northwest as they grow older. So the older forests sequester a lot more carbon than the younger trees. So people sometimes have a sense that, you know, if you have a lot of young trees growing, surely it is sequestering more carbon than having a lot of big old trees. That's not necessarily the case. The young trees grow rapidly, but if you think just about the total biomass and the fact that the older trees are still alive and they're photosynthesizing, so they may be growing more slowly, but they are taking up and sequestering a heck of a lot of carbon. Next slide, please. Also thinking about fire. So especially after the 2020 fire season, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, you know, what about fire? And fires are not good news for humans in these systems, but what about the carbon releases from fire? And is fire releasing a lot of carbon? Actually, not all that much. So if one is thinking about carbon sequestration, the fires that we've had in recent years are not making much of a difference in terms of that, in terms of that overall flux. They're taking up a lot more carbon than they are emitting. And an important thing also to keep in mind is that is that if there's no human intervention in the fire cycle, it's over the longer term, basically it evens out. There's more or less a net zero in terms of carbon uptake and carbon release related to fire in any ecosystem, including the Pacific Northwest. Next slide, please. Also, when one is thinking about trade-offs, because it's all trade-offs and it's all human values, what about tree removal, which is being discussed, especially in some communities, as a potential for reducing fire frequency, potentially fire severity, especially in places where there are a lot of people. And again, there is a lot of credible research, and I'm not going to burden you with lots of citations, but if you're interested, get in touch with me and I can give you references to the credible science, not especially likely to be effective west of the Cascades. So in the old growth forest that a lot of us have in mind, basically when they burn big. And they burn infrequently, I mean, roughly 400 years, give or take, because they are so wet and because the trees are fairly fire resistant, it takes unusual wind, it takes unusual dryness. And when those forests burn, they burn big. So thinning and other types of vegetation removal, sometimes called fuels maintenance, what that means is removing plants, is unlikely to be effective in the old growth forests in the Northwest. Across the Pacific Northwest or the Northwest, depending on how you delineate your regions, it maybe can reduce some of the fire frequency and size, but only with really regular maintenance. That right now, on federal lands anyway, the resources aren't there to do that type of maintenance. Next slide, please. And again, there's also the fact, can we move to the next one? Great, thank you. Also the fact that that again, you know, there's heavy equipment required, trees don't levitate. So what this means in a lot of ecosystems is that the intent with some of the removal is to reduce the likelihood of fire, and reduce the likelihood of fires, especially that can affect human communities and things that a lot of humans value in terms of revenue, recreation, spirituality, what have you. Next slide, please. But especially as climate continues to change, there is, at least in some locations, a high likelihood that that type of ground disturbance is going to lead to increased probability of colonization by non-native grasses, such as cheatgrass, which very definitely increase fire frequency and fire size and make it much more difficult for other types of vegetation to regenerate. So all a matter of trade-offs, last slide. But I am pretty hopeful about what we collectively can do in the Pacific Northwest and about the, as Brenna discussed early on, you know, the advantages of living in the Pacific Northwest and what those forests can represent in terms of national goals and national quality of life. So thank you very much.
Thanks. I'm next. My name is Natalie Dawson. I'm the Executive Director for Audubon Alaska and a Vice President with the National Audubon Society. I've also done research for over 15 years in the Tongass National Forest in Southeast Alaska. I'm a wildlife biologist by training that studied endemic animal populations on the islands of the Tongass National Forest and the impacts of logging on the diversification of these mammal populations. I just want to just start with a photo before I talk numbers and statistics, to just illustrate the wonder of a place like a mature old growth rainforest. There's very few of these kinds of stands left in Southeast Alaska, and I'll get in a little bit to why that is. And I would also just like to acknowledge that the Tongass are the traditional and contemporary homelands of the Tlingit, Tsimshian, and Haida peoples who have been stewarding these lands since time immemorial. The Tongass National Forest is our largest national forest. It stretches 600 miles along the coastline from the Dixon Entrance in the Gulf of Alaska to Prince William Sound. Combined with coastal British Columbia, this is the largest remaining intact temperate rainforest in the world. Coastal temperate rainforests are the most carbon-dense forest ecosystems on the planet. One of the reasons for that is they have more biomass than any other type of ecosystem, which means that they have stored carbon that's several times higher than any other forested system. In the Tongass, the driver of this distribution of biomass is water. Running water actually creates the largest accumulations of stored carbon in biomass, which is expressed in the largest living trees on the forest, as well as rich understory that you can see in this photo. Accumulations of water like bogs, and in Alaska we call bogs muskegs, actually have lower carbon values. Part of that is because of the stunted tree growth and lack of understory. So this means that our greatest carbon storage capacity is actually in low elevation watersheds of the Tongass National Forest, where our mature and old growth forests are found. And that point's going to be important in the next several moments. It's also important to note that coastal temperate rainforests are not systems with large-scale disturbance. So as Dr. Fleischman just showed, in some forest types, fire is a dominant part of the landscape, and tree growth responds to those large disturbances. But in a coastal temperate rainforest, fire is not a natural disturbance event. There actually is no natural large-scale disturbance event. We look at small, like windthrow events and storm cycles that bring small disturbances. So the forest structure, the understory and the overstory, is in many cases evolved over hundreds or thousands of years. And that means that storage capacity is built into those ancient timelines. You can change the slide, thanks. Which brings us to this conundrum that we've had large scale disturbance across a natural system that does not respond in an evolutionary way to large scale disturbance. The Tongass National Forest has been heavily logged. It remains one of the only national forests in the United States where large scale industrial clear cut logging is prioritized over all other forest uses. Even though this logging has always occurred at a net loss of over $20 million a year to American taxpayers, literally we pay for clear cuts, this continues to be the dominant action and investment by the Forest Service in the state of Alaska. A slide change, please. Even amidst this large-scale loss of our stored carbon in ancient forests, the Tongass is still considered our nation's largest solution to climate change. The standing forests of the Tongass sequester more carbon than any other U.S. national forest lands in the country, and combined with the soil and the woody debris from downed trees, contain 8% of our nation's total forest carbon, which you can see in the map on the right. One thing that we haven't even started to really skim the surface on is also the stored carbon in blue carbon networks. Southeast Alaska, of which the Tongass National Forest is found, is an island system over thousands of islands and 18,000 miles of coastline, which is more coastline than the rest of the U.S. combined. Those coastlines are actually estuary systems that store, in some cases, up to four times the amount of carbon as the terrestrial area around that estuary. So the amount of carbon storage in the Tongass is still an equation that we're trying to figure out in terms of the amount of carbon that can be sequestered in this natural system to mitigate the impacts of climate change. A slide change, please. The Tongass is also home to some of the world's richest biodiversity hotspots, and this is often unknown by people. So the map on the left shows relative species richness of endemic mammals on the Tongass. And I put the mammals map up because in evolutionary biology, mammals on islands are actually the last ones to usually express genetic diversity because they're the least mobile, right? It takes them longer to get to islands where birds, plants, insects can spread themselves quicker and thus diversify quicker. It takes mammals a long time. So given the level of endemism, which means regional distinctiveness in genetic as well as physical characteristics, given the level of endemism found in the Tongass National Forest on the islands, we have 24 endemic mammal species and subspecies, we can assume that those levels of endemism are even higher for other species groups. This map that I've put up is a map we created to show hotspots of biological diversity, similar to what we do for tropical regions of the world. You can see that hot red spot is the Prince of Wales Island Complex, which is a small complex of islands within the larger Tongass National Forest. It has also been the most heavily impacted set of islands in all of the forest. Prince of Wales Island alone has lost over 94% of its ancient and mature old growth forests. And so areas where we have the highest biological diversity tend to be the ones where we've had the most significant habitat impacts over the last 60 years. Next slide, please. These are just a few of my favorite endemic colleagues that I've spent a lot of time with over the past years. So I wanted to give a shout out to them. The Pacific Martin in the upper left-hand corner was described as a new species in 2008. The Haida ermine in the upper right corner is a short-tailed weasel, that's its other name. It was described as a new species just recently in 2021. The Alexander Archipelago Wolf, which has been petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act in 1996, in 2011, and again was petitioned in 2020, remains one of the most genetically diverse branches of all of our North American wolves, harboring genetic diversity that was long ago extirpated from all other wolf populations due to the massive predator control campaigns across the US. So in some cases, the islands of the Tongass National Forest actually harbor the last remaining diversity for a species such as the North American wolf. The Alexander Archipelago wolf is a subspecies of the North American gray wolf, Canis lupus lagoni. And then the far low right corner is the Prince of Wales Island flying squirrel, a distinct subspecies of flying squirrel just found on Prince of Wales and surrounding islands that actually eats truffles. So pretty cool. Next slide. Before I get into this map, I just want to mention that it's not only wildlife species diversity on the Tongass National Forest that we need to keep in mind, but also human diversity. There's 19 federally recognized tribes found in Southeast Alaska. And these indigenous communities are prioritizing traditional uses of the landscape and trying to bring equity to forest management practices. So when we think of forest policy and the changes we want to see under the new administration, one of those is in consultation, both in government to government consultation, as well as co-management structures to change the way in which decisions are made. Recently, the tribes of Southeast Alaska petitioned the U.S. Forest Service in response to the loss of the roadless rule for a new rulemaking process, a traditional homelands rule. There's also a new memorandum of understanding between the Forest Service and tribes across Southeast through the Central Council, Tlingit and Haida tribes of Southeast Alaska to create an Indigenous Guardians Network. This is all to say that we need shifting management and protections beyond just the roadless rule, which has been one of the governing conversations in the Tongass over the last several years. The map on the left shows you cumulative ecological risk in the Tongass National Forest, again highlighting places like Prince of Wales Island. On the right, you see a risk assessment that we did associated with mining. And that's one of the issues that the roadless rule doesn't actually really cover. And Southeast Alaska actually contains some of the world's richest rare earth element deposits for some of what's been called critical minerals that are used in things like solar panels and batteries for renewable energy systems. And so as we see an uptick in mineral development, we need to be thinking about what role we're going to play in protecting mature and old growth forests for these other actions, just besides timber harvest that we don't necessarily associate with forests, but are going to be very important as we think about that combination of protecting places that are natural solutions to climate change and trying to mitigate the other impacts of climate change like renewable energy infrastructure. Last slide. And that brings me back to the complexity of this place. It's an island archipelago. There's so many diverse uses. There's incredible biodiversity. And we do feel like there is an opportunity now to think about some forward-thinking policy that can help create change and protect these mature and old growth forests and our nation's largest carbon reserve. Thanks.
Great, thanks for that, Natalie. My name is Susan Jane Brown. I'm the Wildlands Program Director and Staff Attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center. I am here in Portland, Oregon, and I am talking to you on the ancestral lands of the Cowlitz, the Grand Ronde, and the Clackamas people. Next slide, please. So I'm gonna talk to you all a little bit about the Northwest Forest Plan. We heard a little bit about Alaska, which is a really fantastic ecosystem deserving of protection. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the protections that we do have in place on the west side of the Cascades within the range of the Northern Spotted Owl. So that's Western Oregon, Western Washington, and Northwest California. And as a staff attorney, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the law and how the law was used to drive the development of the Northwest Forest Plan. And it's important to note that actually the National Forest Management Act was the original prime driver behind the kerfuffle around the Northern Spotted Owl. And that's because the Northern Spotted Owl was actually listed as a management indicator species in many forest plans. And the National Forest Management Act and the regulations that were adopted in 1982, which were subsequently revised in 2012, but the 1982 planning rule requires that the Forest Service maintain viable populations of management indicator species. And as a management indicator species, the spotted owl was intended to be an indicator of old growth forest habitat. So as goes the owl, so goes its habitat. And therefore, by extension, there goes the overall health of the ecosystem. As a management indicator species, early on, advocates were tracking the populations and the habitat of this species, and aided by a number of biologists, both federal and non-federal biologists, who were also tracking the population of spotted owls. Advocates were able to use the data coming from that information, which showed that the spotted owl's population was dramatically declining. And so that was really the impetus leading to quite a bit of successful litigation in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that resulted in region-wide injunctions that precluded management, and that means logging, of spotted owl habitat. And I guess I should pause. I assume everyone knows what these critters are. But the critter on the far left there is a northern spotted owl. The puffball to the top of the page is a spotted owl owlet, baby spotted owl. And below him is a Marbre murrelet, which is a seabird that spends most of its time in the ocean fishing, but nests in coastal old growth forests. And then on the far right there, these are the forests that we're talking about. These are our ancient old growth forests on the west side of the Cascades. And so this is really sort of the harbinger of what we were fighting for back in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And so as we were using the National Forest Management Act, and this was before the spotted owl was listed as a threatened species, it was also before the Marbre murrelet was listed. Both of these species were actually listed under court order because the wildlife agencies and the land management agencies refused to list. Despite the overwhelming scientific information showing that these species were in deep decline. As a result of the region-wide injunctions that were entered by Judge Dwyer in the early 1990s, the agencies, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, which together managed about 24 million acres of land in the range of the Northern Spotted Owl, the agencies announced that in response to the injunctions that they would in fact attempt to develop a spotted owl conservation plan, which was called the Interagency Scientific Committee Plan, or the ISC plan. So this is a little bit of history for folks. And the plan's development was driven by Jack Ward Thomas, who was an elk biologist. So he definitely understood the biology of wildlife species, but he was an elk guy, not an owl guy. But he was tapped to lead this effort, and at the time was the Forest Service's chief research wildlife biologist, and he would go on to become chief of the Forest Service later in the mid-1990s. The ISC plan, Interagency Scientific Committee plan, was a step forward, but was not sufficient to protect the spotted owl and its needed viability. And there were several additional owl plans that came out after the ISC plan, and each plan would go before Judge Dwyer, and he would say, nope, not good enough. You're still not maintaining the viability of this management indicator species, the spotted owl, which by that time was then listed as threatened under the ESA. So now we have NIFMA viability concerns regarding the species. And now once the spotted owl and the murrelet were listed under the ESA, then we have survival and recovery concerns about both of these species because their numbers were so low. And later on, we would then also have additional listings of fish species, salmonids and native fishes as well. So the drumbeat for actually coming up with a plan that would address the needs of these species became larger and larger. Next slide, please. And so I just wanted to share this quote from you. After we had the various owl plans that did not pass legal muster, we had Judge Dwyer continuing to keep into place region-wide injunctions that precluded any logging in owl habitat. President Clinton actually campaigned on this logjam. And he said, if you elect me, I will come to Portland and I will hold a forest summit and I will fix it all. And believe it or not, that's what he did. He was elected, and shortly after his inauguration, he brought half of his cabinet to Portland and held a forest summit where he brought together stakeholders, although not elected officials, but other stakeholders, and listened to them for several days while he took it all in. And at the end of the forest summit, he tasked his cabinet and the Forest Service and Jack Ward Thomas to come up with a plan that would meet legal muster. And so I think that this is a really good quote. I think President Clinton was very prescient about the difficulties that he would face, because at the end of the day, after the Northwest Forest Plan was developed, next slide, please, nobody was happy. Everyone was unhappy. The conservation community was unhappy because the Northwest Forest Plan actually does not preclude the harvest of mature and old growth forests. The timber industry was also unhappy because we went from logging about 5 billion board feet of timber per year to about 1.5 billion on a good year. And so the timber industry wasn't happy, and rural communities who were largely timber dependent at the time saw their livelihoods change dramatically with the development and advent of industrialization, as well as declining timber harvest as a result of the Northwest Forest Plan, mechanization, international markets, that sort of thing. So I want to talk just a little bit about the Northwest Forest Plan. I'm not going to get into the weeds on this because we don't have time, but it is a good step forward, but it is not perfect. And there is definitely a need today to advance the protections for mature and old growth forests. The Northwest Forest Plan was the first ecosystem management plan in the country, and I would argue in the world. And so it is precedent setting, and it did set a very high bar. It was designed to be set scientifically sound, ecologically credible, and legally responsible. That's what President Clinton promised, and that's what Judge Dwyer held, that the plan was in fact legal, although barely, and only based on future events, which we can talk about in Q&A if folks want. The Northwest Forest Plan does include aquatic and terrestrial protections, wildlife mitigation. This is the survey and manage program, which requires the agency to look before it logs and then protect rare and endemic species. And then also monitoring adaptive management. So it's a very complicated, complex plan. It does restrict harvest of green trees older than 80 years of age in some places, i.e. in late successional reserves, which are were designed to be set aside for old growth habitat development, although important to note that within those LSRs, it's not like there's 100% of maternal growth forest in those reserves. And in fact, many reserves, LSRs, have anywhere from 40 to 60 to 80% older forest in them. So there's quite a bit of younger forest located in these LSRs that are set aside as old growth reserves. So there is a prohibition on harvesting trees older than 80 years of age in LSRs, but that does not apply to trees that have been burned in forests. It is easier to log forest that's been burned in LSR. So just because you're an old growth tree and have been affected by fire does not mean that you are going to make it in the LSRs. And so writ large, there's no prohibition on logging mature and old growth forest within the Northwest Forest Plan range of the spotted owl. I'd also like to point out that the Northwest Forest Plan originally applied to the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, but in 2016, the BLM went through a revision process, a resource management plan revision process. And despite Kristen and I's best efforts, we did not succeed in our legal challenge, challenging BLM's succession from the Northwest Forest Plan. And so most of the old growth logging that we see today within the range of the spotted owl is actually happening on those BLM lands under their new resource management plan. So a lot of old growth and older forest is being lost to loggers on the BLM lands, the Oregon and California lands, which are predominantly located in Southwest Oregon. Despite best efforts, the Northwest Forest Plan has not stopped the decline of many wildlife species. Salmonids, marble murrelets, spotted owls, their numbers continue to plummet. And so we have a situation where we've got this good resource management plan, but it actually hasn't stopped the decline of many of the species that we're concerned about. The new administration's executive orders that they've issued make it clear that it is a priority of this administration to conserve biodiversity and take action on the climate crisis and to do so in an environmental justice lens. These are absolutely our issues here in the Pacific Northwest, particularly on the wet west side. And so it makes sense that looking here as well as looking at the Tongass is a good place for this administration to start as it thinks about how it's going to go about actually implementing the lofty goals that they've put forward in their executive orders. So the time for action is now. And with that, I will hand it over to my friend, Kristen.
Thank you, SJ, and hello, and thank you all for hanging in there with us on a Tuesday evening. My name is Kristen Boyles, and I am a staff attorney at Earth Justice, coming to you from my kitchen in Seattle, Washington, which is in the coastal ancestral lands of the Coast Salish peoples, in particular the Duwamish tribe. And for those who are also in Seattle, the Duwamish have a program called Real Rent, and you could sign up to voluntarily donate a particular monthly amount to sort of be at least try to make up for some of the damage that we have all done by settling in other people's lands. I am going to try to take the next 8 minutes to do two things. I want to set out a big picture ask of the Biden administration on forestry and climate. That's the first thing. And the second thing, I want to talk about just enough law to satisfy the ability for you all to get CLE credits for this panel. So we'll see how I do. I and so many others that are on this call and on this panel have been fighting in court to protect old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest for decades. And that fight is often viewed through different lenses, depending on what you're talking about. You know, sometimes that you're talking about ecosystem protection, sometimes biodiversity, sometimes threatened endangered species like the northern spotted owl or marble murrelet. The lens we want to use tonight is climate, and particularly the carbon storage that we've got in our big old growth forests. And a particularly salient statistic I've recently been reading is that scientists have found that the largest 1% of trees in an old growth forest contain fully half of all the above ground biomass. And that means half of the carbon that is stored as well, because that is, their two are directly connected. So 1% of the old growth forests is accounting for half of the carbon that is stored by those forests. Young trees, as the slide by from Dr. Fleshman showed, they take up a lot of carbon as they're growing quickly, but they cannot make up for, and they cannot account for the amount, just the sheer massive amount of carbon that you get in the large trees that's in their trunks and in their branches and has accumulated over decades and decades. So next slide. So here is the two-step policy framework that we want to talk about. The first is, and of course my phone is ringing right now, the first is executive action to halt mature and old growth forest logging in the Pacific Northwest and the Tongass National Forest in Alaska immediately. And the second is, on a parallel track, is a rulemaking to establish a national natural carbon reserve system across our federal lands that is then able to put that rule in place for perpetuity. This is in line also with what the Biden administration has been talking about as their 30 by 30, 30% of the public lands protected by 2030. Next slide. And while we're having this discussion, I just want to remind everybody that old growth forests are in fact resistant and resilient to fire. Again, previous panelists have talked about this. Thick bark, high canopies, cool, moist areas, not so windy microclimates. Old growth forests are places where we don't have the same risk of fire that we have in other places. And in fact, fire, when we do have it, has not been entirely devastating, and there are owls and other old growth critters who end up living in fire landscapes. Because these older mature forests have the biggest potential to sequester and store significant amounts of carbon and have been doing so for the last 200 years or more, Forest Carbon Reserve is also fitting in with the United States's renewed and oh so happy to see these efforts on climate, global international climate protection. These can count as solid, accountable actions, protection of forests as carbon reserves for the international agreements under the Paris Accord that we have now rejoined, and in time for the next meeting in, I believe, Glasgow, Scotland in November, all again under the Paris Agreement. Next slide, please. I also want to be clear that this idea of the importance of old growth forests for carbon storage is not really new news, even if the way we talk about it is. 30 years ago in this region, there was a region-wide injunction to protect northern spotted owls and the old growth forests they depended upon. And the district court made a series of explicit findings of fact, which included this reminder, if anybody needed it, that forest is more than just trees. Next slide, please. It also included these findings of facts about old growth forests sustaining biological communities, and also that they're important for their impacts on climate and air quality. And again, that this is now well over 30 years ago. Next slide, please. So I want to turn to an example where this kind of policy framework, a moratorium that goes into effect quickly with a longer term rulemaking to pass a rule that is much more broad and sweeping, has worked before. And that's with respect to the Forest Service roadless rule, which was promulgated by the Clinton administration in January of 2001. And in the late 1990s and even earlier than that, the science and the forestry managers were pretty clear that roads and road construction were key drivers of harm to ecosystems and species, and that roadless areas, those areas that had been identified previously as areas 5,000 acres or greater with no significant roads, could serve as a sort of proxy for intact habitats and forests. And so it was a similar two-part proposal then to the Clinton administration, a moratorium on activities in roadless areas, followed then by a national rulemaking that went through a full environmental impact statement process under the National Environmental Policy Act, that went through consultation under the Endangered Species Act, that again led up to the roadless rule. Next slide, please. And it took some persuading. I mean, although, you know, SJ talked about Clinton coming in and he's going to get the Northwest Forest Plan done, by this time, you know, big policy objectives don't just happen. It took an entire campaign, called at that time America's Heritage Forest Campaign, formed from national and then regional and local groups, to really lobby hard and use, you know, your regular meetings and paid publicity and other kinds of forms of lobbying to launch the campaign to get the roadless areas protected. This is one such ad that ran in newspapers nationwide. Next, please. And so, in fact, that's exactly what happened. There was a moratorium on road building, just on the road building part, in January of 1998. That was immediately challenged by the timber industry, but several years later, that challenge lost because they didn't have any standing to challenge a moratorium on road building in areas that were under the Forest Service's control. And it is also important to remember, we're just talking about Forest Service lands here at this point in time. Next slide, please. 3 years later, after a long process of the, you know, the scoping and the draft EIS and commenting and public hearings across the nation, right at the end of the Clinton administration, the roadless rule was finalized and promulgated. It said there was no road building and no commercial logging in identified roadless areas, which at the time was 58.5 million acres of Forest Service land across the nation. Next slide, please. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, what was their authority to do this? How could they just sort of lock up this much land? But this authority comes from the Forest Service Organic Act itself, 1897. You know, that the Forest Service can make those such rules and regulations to prevent the destruction of the forests. And the forests are more than just the trees, they are the ecosystem. And this is the same kind of language you could use to support the passing of the creation of a carbon reserve, forestry carbon reserve. Again, this is Forest Service. BLM in the Department of Interior has similar language one could draw on, but it's slightly different agency. Next slide, please. The existence of the Wilderness Act from 1964 also is important to think about when you're thinking about protection of large swaths of land. The Wilderness Act does not allow for the agency to protect land. The Wilderness Act talks about the authority of Congress to designate wilderness areas, but it does talk about the agency able to protect lands in advance of becoming a wilderness area, and that how that the Forest Service can work hand in hand with Congress to evaluate wilderness potential. And so yet another legal avenue for supporting the creation of some sort of carbon reserve. Next slide, please. Next, oh, there we go. The roadless rule was immediately challenged. The Bush administration took office a mere 2 weeks after the roadless rule was promulgated, and the litigation history of the roadless rule is much too convoluted to get into in this discussion. But I wanted to point out that the public campaign continued throughout the litigation. While things were going on in court, while there were injunctions and the rule was repealed by the Bush administration, and then it was put back by a set of courts, public campaign continued to build to have that public support for this idea of a roadless rule and what the roadless rule really stood for and meant. It was a conscious effort to keep that campaign alive. That effort continued into the Obama administration. By the time we got to 2009 in the Obama administration, the rule was still being litigated, where we had to lobby some of the same people whose names we are now seeing in the Biden administration to stand behind and support the roadless rule, even as they're coming in newly to office. So the importance of that continued campaign and continued discussion about it, it's hard to overstate. Next slide. In fact, this sign I took a picture of at the 2019 climate strike in Seattle, March for Climate in Seattle, Washington. And there really wasn't much discussion about the roadless rule at all at the time in front of then President Trump. I show it to share what I think is important that the public campaign succeeded here by making the roadless rule sort of a common term that we understood what that meant It didn't just mean roads, it meant the forest ecosystems that that depended on those areas. It meant protecting these areas, and it became the shorthand that people understood. And I think that's what we need to do now when we're talking about having a forest carbon reserve on our national public lands. Next slide, please. So in the international lingo, there are activities called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, that each country that is a signatory to the Paris Agreement will commit to. And those are supposed to be actions that, and objectives that are actually going to do something. They're actually going to reduce carbon and help affect climate change. Those are due on Earth Day. And it will be interesting to see what the Biden administration puts on its list of things that are its nationally determined contributions. Like I said earlier, the actual conference is in Glasgow in November. And I think it's critical that the United States resume its role as an international leader in addressing climate change and the climate crisis, and put forest protections as a priority. And we've done very well and good to say we should stop deforestation in the Amazon, but we've not done very good in our own home turf to say that there are deforestation issues that we should be addressing here, closer to home in our temperate rainforests, on public lands that are still being logged, despite all the science that says that this is our best hope for having a carbon storage system that is credible and actually works. And so I think we can't remain a credible voice in the international community without calling for this. And so that's the call to y'all, to get that the message here is this idea of our national, not sure what we actually call it, I'm sure I'm butchering its name, but a national carbon reserve system on our federal public lands in this administration. So with that, I will end and turn it to Brenna, who I think can moderate questions if that's where we are.
Yes, that's where we are. Thank you, Kristen. There are a lot of questions. We're not going to have time to get to all of them. And I did try and answer some of them in the Q&A. But I wanted to start with a question that I think was echoed many times. People are wondering, what can they do to try and either decrease the amount of logging on public lands or pressure the Biden administration to take action to protect it? Both of those questions, they showed up in a variety of ways. Another way of saying it is like, how do we decrease the timber targets? Or what are different personal actions or collective actions that we can take? It's open to all of you. And then I have some ideas at the end.
I don't know who wants to go first. I'll go first. So I think a couple of things. One, like Kristen was talking about, making sure that there is fertile ground for policy direction like what we're talking about to take effect is really important. And so, you know, it sounds a little trite, but writing your congressperson and letting them know that these issues are important to you and that they should support them, particularly as the new administration is going through their appointees, that kind of advocacy can be helpful because lawmakers, and this is Congress, which is a little bit different than the administration, but Congress also needs to hear that these issues are important to their constituents, because if they don't hear that, they're not going to be willing to support these kinds of actions. So unfortunately, or fortunately, writing your congressman is an important thing to do, congresswoman, senators also. And I do think that you know, we do have some exciting new appointees that are coming in, particularly Deb Hallen, who's over at Interior. And Interior oversees, for example, the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a very important wildlife management agency. And expressing the importance of biodiversity conservation, which happens by conserving habitat, and we're talking about mature and old growth habitat here, letting the administration know that those things are priorities for the American people is equally as important. So I'd offer those two things as potential steps that folks can take.
Anybody else want to chime in on this question?
Well, I don't have a specific answer of what you a person can personally do right now, but this is the issue that's going to be getting a lot of traction with all groups in the Pacific Northwest and up in the Tongass sort of pushing on the Biden administration. So individuals can get involved in that kind of campaign to be convincing the Biden folks that this is the path that they want to take. I suspect there will be comment periods. I suspect there'll be requests for, you know, letter writing and things like that. So there are ways to engage in that effort because we need to first get the Biden administration to decide this is a good idea before we can go to the next step of saying, okay, what are its details of it?
Thanks. And I want to also answer that from an organizing perspective. If you are in the Pacific Northwest region from Washington down to Northern California, over the past year, we've been organizing the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, which is bringing together groups who have traditionally focused on climate change, like 350s and Sunrise Movement, and connecting them with more traditional land conservation groups throughout the Northwest to build a grassroots movement where we're sharing information and messaging between each other, really showing up as a collective voice to never talk about climate without talking about forests and never talk about forests without talking about climate. So if you or your organization is interested in becoming a member of the Alliance, I'm one of the steering committee members and you can email me. My email is brenna@bark-out.org and I can get you connected with the Alliance because we're trying to build that grassroots swell that will create the fertile ground for our senators and representatives and the Biden administration to take action.